This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Getting less of a bad thing is a good thing, unless you've still got plenty of that bad thing. The bad thing here being lost jobs, 216,000 of them last month, leaving us a long way from normal. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, sponsoring the retirement planning documentary Retirement Revolution, September 15th on PBS. Local listings at pbs.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Friday, everybody. It is the 4th of September, and what we have here is another one of those on the one hand, on the other hand, economic reports. The August unemployment report hit the streets this morning. The jobless rate jumped again last month from 9.4 to 9.7%. Now, for the other hand, the number of jobs lost, 216,000, as I mentioned, while sizable, is the smallest we've had in a year. So balancing it out, bad, good, it's hard to tell, really. We haven't seen a healthy job market in so long, we may have trouble remembering what one's supposed to look like. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Losing more than 200,000 jobs may not seem like the road to recovery until you consider what a long, awful trip it's been, says Lawrence Michel of the Economic Policy Institute.
The job losses are about a third of what they were earlier this year, although it'd be much better to see, you know, fast job growth and rapidly falling unemployment.
And Michel knows how many new jobs would be required.
We need to be able to have 127,000 jobs a month created before we see unemployment start to fall.
Let's call that normal job growth, the economy absorbing all the new people entering the labor market every month, high school and college graduates, immigrants, stay-at-home moms who aren't staying home anymore. For that to happen, companies first have to stop laying people off. Then they have to gain enough confidence in the economy to take the risk of hiring again. Michel and other economists think it'll be mid-2010 before normal job growth like that returns. Bernard Beaumal is with the Economic Outlook Group.
It's going to take us a really long time to bring back the 7 million jobs that have been lost since the start of this recession. My guess is 4 to 5 years.
Beaumal says changes in the economy have shrunk some industries permanently. Think automaking, financial services, residential and commercial construction. He says some of those jobs are probably never coming back. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The thing about an economic recovery, when it does eventually come, is that everything doesn't get better all at once. Clearly, the U.S. labor market is still struggling. Housing, at least, is not getting too much worse. But investors in the capital market, stocks and bonds, they are full of sunshine and light. Since March, they've been buying up plain old shares like crazy, and now they're getting an appetite for more exotic fare as well. Things like stock options and bonds with really lousy ratings. We read today that companies in emerging markets whose bonds are rated as junk, that is, the riskiest companies in some of the riskiest markets, have sold more debt in the past 7 weeks than they have in the past year. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson explains why investors are getting a taste for dangerous living.
Just like in a casino on Wall Street, the name of the game is high risk, high yield. If you don't lose your shirt, taking a gamble can pay off big time. And Marilyn Cohen of Envision Capital Management says that's just what's driving investors right now.
bond fund managers that I know as friends in the business are saying they are getting such humongous amounts of money flowing into their funds, they can't place it, invest it fast enough.
What a difference a year makes. PIMCO's Tony Crescenzi says chalk it up to high yields. Corporate bonds are paying 9.5% on average. That's off the highs, but still well above normal. And companies are predicting good days ahead.
That means more cash flow, more cash to pay back bond investors. So the risks of default have subsided for some companies. They're not gone completely, though. There are a lot of risks still.
We're expecting about a 14% default rate next year.
That's David Weiss, chief economist at Standard & Poor's. He says 14% is risky, but...
frankly, the prices seem high enough to justify taking that risk. Yeah, it's like you take a whole batch of gambles. Some of them are going to fail, but the ones that succeed are going to pay off enough to cover your losses.
Now, before you go putting all your money into risky debt, David Weiss says keep in mind nothing is ever a sure thing.
And one thing that bothers us is last summer, things seemed to be progressing this way, too. Risk was coming down. We were getting back to normal.
And we all know how that turned out. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
There will be some changes to labor rules on the heels of Labor Day. Starting Tuesday, federal contractors are going to have to check a job applicant's legal status before letting them begin work. The requirement to use a free online database known as E-Verify is part of an effort to keep undocumented workers off the government payroll. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
E-Verify checks a person's identity and citizenship against government databases. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce calls the system a burden for employers, but at least one corporation disagrees.
It's not a very time-consuming program.
Charles Brimmer is with the employment company Manpower. On any given day, the firm employs about 400,000 people worldwide. Those in the U.S. are all checked using E-Verify.
It takes 3 to 5 seconds to get a result right back in the system about their eligibility to work in the United States.
And if Brimmer has problems...
the help desk for the government is great. I've called a variety of times and someone's on the phone within 5 or 10 seconds. I barely have to wait.
E-Verify can pose challenges for small businesses. Kim Carmichael is with Watson & Cochran, a cabinet maker in Texas. She had started taking an online tutorial on how to use E-Verify.
And there's all of this information that you have to read, and you have to take courses and take tests and pass the tests. And I spent about a day and a half, and I wasn't even halfway finished, so I just quit in the middle of the process and decided that we weren't going to do it.
Carmichael could give up because her company isn't a government contractor. But that exemption may not last. Congress is considering legislation that would require all employers to use E-Verify. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
That jobs report gave traders a swift kick in the pants today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As Mitchell Hartman told us up at the top of the broadcast, it's likely to be a good long while before people who've lost their jobs find new ones. And given the way this economy has changed over the past couple of years, when they are hired again, those people may well find the nature of working itself has changed. Commentator Glenn Miller is one of those easing his way back into the labor market. And frankly, he's not quite sure what to make of it.
You might call me an early adapter to the Great Recession. I was laid off in its first official month. Now I seem to be an equally early adapter to the around-the-corner, just-within-reach, can-you-hear-it-coming, Great Rebound. I spent the first months of my layoff composing cover letters, attempting to convince companies that I was their perfect candidate, to no avail. But having worked in communications and video production companies, I was often contacted by past clients. "We need a series of videos produced. Can you direct them?" they would ask. "No," I responded in that early hopeful phase. "I'm sorry, but I need to stay focused on the job search." After my third such request, I came to my senses and took on the project. In time, the project work became, well, just work. I became an S corporation, set up a home office, pajama attire allowed, and established a website. I was back in the game. But wait, within the course of 1 week, two of my clients announced that they had set up desks, cubicles, and a nameplate for me. I had seemingly been laid on. "Thank you," I said meekly, "but I have a desk. It's at my company." You need one here, too, they both said. But here's my fear. As I continue to work diligently from my home office, people will see my oft-empty cubicle and wonder where I am. Who's the slacker, they might say. So what's the protocol here? Should I display family photos, tchotchkes? Perhaps I could sublet my space to one of my subcontractors. Maybe hire someone to desk-sit? And I wonder, is this just a land grab by nervous managers or a precursor to a full-time job offer, like letting the car warm up on those cold winter mornings before you actually take it for a drive? These are the times we live in. Companies with a surfeit of office and cube space inviting chaps like me to hang with them. Well, in this current economy, I'm certainly happy to do so. But one question, can I still wear my pajamas?
Glenn Miller is the president of that corporation that he named after himself. We would love to hear from you. Write to us at marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. This really wasn't all that lazy a summer. The past 3 months have been fairly busy news-wise, obviously in healthcare. But on the theory we're going to hear enough about that once Congress comes back next week, we're going to talk about something else right now, how to fix the banking system. Last night, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner shared his thoughts in an op-ed in the Financial Times. So for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond, we turn to Felix Salmon from Reuters and John Carney from ClusterStock.com. Hi again, guys.
Good to talk to you, Kay.
Thanks for having us.
John, we're going to go with you first this week. I need the 30-second layman's version of what the Treasury Secretary is proposing. And I have to tell you, if you use the word tangible common equity or capitalization ratios, I'm going to turn off your microphone, all right?
It's going to be tough, but here it is. The government wants the banks to have more money on hand for a rainy day. They want them to save during good times so that they can tap into it in bad times.
More money in the bank, then.
Right. More money in their reserves, not just more deposits, which are actually what they owe to their depositors, but money that they have saved up in their own account so that they can tap into it when their mortgage loans start to go balooey.
Balooey. That's a good word.
Felix, wasn't there also an element in this plan of, you know what, a global banking system, you need to think as a system and not just as individual countries and individual institutions?
Yes, he's paying a certain amount of lip service to the idea that all of the different regulators in different countries should be holding banks in different countries to the same standards. But what he's also saying is that the Federal Reserve in the US should really be keeping an eye on the system as a whole, rather than saying, well, you know, Citigroup looks okay, and Merrill Lynch looks okay, and Lehman Brothers looks okay, and then so we're happy. What it can start doing is look at the entire stock of debt in the economy and in the financial system, go back to the banks and say, you know what, if it was just you, we would be able to cope. But the fact is that everyone is doing this, and when everyone is doing this, that causes a huge systemic danger, and so we're going to force all of you to buck up and start raising some more capital before things go wrong.
John, what do you think of this plan? I mean, is it sound?
I think it's a very good plan, actually. Instead of just glancing at how close one bank is getting to the edge, you're looking at whether they're all marching in lockstep towards that edge. That's a really good idea.
Felix, do you think any of this is actually going to be enforced? I mean, the G20 finance ministers are meeting this weekend. The leaders are meeting in Pittsburgh later this month. Are they going to come to some conclusion about this?
My gut feeling is that they're not. I have to say I'm a little bit pessimistic about all this. There's a lot of politics involved in the G20 meetings, and I'm sure they will come out with some kind of a communique which will have lots of grand sweeping gestures towards global cooperation and so on and so forth. But when push comes to shove, what you really need in order to have the Geithner plan work is legislation signed into law. And that's going to be difficult in the United States. It's going to be difficult across Europe. So I'm not that optimistic.
All right. Well, in light of that then, John, let me run a pet theory by you that I've had for a number of months now. That what we have here, given the fact that banks seem to be getting healthier and the crisis is fading into memory, what we've got is a crisis wasted, that we're not going to be able to take the regulatory reforms we need to prevent a crisis like this from ever happening again. Anything in these proposals that you think proves me wrong?
a positive way of spinning this is to say, of spinning the crisis wasted, yes, is we actually have a very bad history of responding to things right, very quickly after a crisis. So perhaps what we'll do is take the time to find out what really went wrong and try to really fix that instead of settling on some quick Band-Aid on something that might not have even been a problem. For instance, in the G20 meeting right now, there's a division going on between what the Europeans think is the problem, which is the way bankers were paid and the bonuses drove them to risk-taking. The U.S. says is that it was a deeper structural problem with the way the banks were capitalized. Those are two different views, and I think we're going to see that clash at the G20.
Felix Salmon from Reuters and John Carney at ClusterStock.com. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Kay.
Thank you.
Coming up, who do we have to thank for those 2 days off?
For people who are not steeped in labor history, it might take a few minutes to figure out what on earth are they talking about. You know, the weekend has always been here like the weather.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials moved up 1% today, 96 points, closed at 9,441. The NASDAQ picked up 1.75%, 35 points, finished at 2,018. The S&P 500 rose 1.3%, that is 13 points, rounded out the day. The S&P did at 1,016. For the week, not such a good one. The Dow gave back 1.1%, the NASDAQ reversed 0.5%, the S&P 500 forfeited 1.2%. Financial firms saw the good in today's jobs report. Citigroup banked 1.23%. Bank of America deposited 1.5%. J.P. Morgan Chase took home 0.5%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.44%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org. Miss anything in business news this week? Download our new podcast, After the Bell. Every Friday, Scott Jagow makes sense of the week in business and the economy. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link. Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Monday. It's a holiday staple, no stock market. You can plot how to make your millions while standing over a barbecue. Vice President Biden gets into the Labor Day spirit. He travels to Pittsburgh for the city's annual parade. And more reasons to draw you to the couch. ESPN debuted 30 years ago on September 7th, 1979. Its first show was SportsCenter. Now its flagship news program. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's not every company whose offices are almost as well known as it is. But if you're a sports fan, and maybe even if you're not, you've probably seen the cubicles and the control room, even the cafeteria of ESPN. We've come to their 100-acre campus here in Bristol, Connecticut, which plays almost as big a role in those tongue-in-cheek ads for SportsCenter as the sports stars and mascots do.
That whole Brett Favre thing was really hard to keep track of. So we had to come up with a system.
So is it one if retired, two if unretired?
I think it's the other way around.
ESPN first went on the air 30 years ago this coming Monday. Slow pitch softball was the first game on that night. Things are different now. Along with dozens of cable networks, the ESPN brand reaches across radio, the internet, a line of books, video games, all the way to a chain of restaurants.
The boss will see you now.
Today on Conversations from the Corner Office, a man who's been with the company almost since the beginning. I met ESPN President George Bodenheimer in the SportsCenter studios to talk about the network's smart aleck attitude and what ESPN really means for sports. This is a big year for ESPN, 30 years on the air. You've been here 29 of those years. When you first started, literally in the mailroom, did you have any idea
that this is where you'd be sitting 30 years later in the middle of this complex?
No. Back then, it was considered absolutely crazy to have a 24-hour network devoted solely to sports.
How much of the phenomenon, though, that you guys have become is because people are so passionate about sports? I mean, if you had been, you know, a show about welding or something, I don't know that you'd be where you are today.
No, it's about the passion of sports. One of my early jobs here was to drive around Texas, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, and Mississippi and sell ESPN to cable operators. And I'm telling you, every town I pulled into, the cable operator would say to me, you know, George, this is a sports town. And every town in America believes they're a sports town. And ESPN came along at a time to tap into that.
There must have been a fair amount, though, in those early days as you were doing sales and marketing, of you making your pitch to somebody and them saying, ESPN what?
Oh, yeah. We had a lot of that. You know, it was early stories of people thinking it was a headache powder. I mean, it was a Spanish network. I mean, we were misthought of a lot in the early days. But it was pretty easy to describe once you talk to somebody. It's 24-hour sports. And the notion, you know, quickly caught on.
One of the things I think that's helped you guys get where you are is the attitude that you have. You're not stuffy about it. You're relaxed. Some would say irreverent. Some would go farther and say cocky. Is that intentional? Did you plan that from the beginning?
No, I can't say it was planned from the beginning. It just grew up here. I mean, we take our sports seriously, but we don't take ourselves too seriously. And we also believe that the notion of sports should be fun. And that people want to be entertained, and they're inviting us into their homes. Let's have some fun.
And watch how fast this pitch is. 98 miles an hour. See, very naughty. Yeah, it's very naughty.
Give me some insight into your business model. How do you, when you start thinking about bidding for a golf major, as you've been doing, or the recent contract with the SEC in college football, walk me through that process.
Well, essentially, as sports fans, we want to acquire the things that we ourselves, in effect, would want to watch, right? I mean, so we've been on a run where we're buying world-class properties, you know, whether it's the British Open, the SEC football and basketball contracts. So we're improving our offerings to fans.
Do you worry about the price of those contracts and that it might eventually become unaffordable for you to keep going?
I mean, I certainly, it's something that I think about, but I wouldn't say I worry about it. You know, we've never said we have to own everything here, and we, in fact, don't today. So, you know, if things get priced where we can't afford them, we'll shift our direction.
Are we ever going to see ESPN doing the Super Bowl?
You know, I certainly wouldn't rule it out. I mean, if we'd have done this interview 15 years ago and you'd asked me, you know, do you see ESPN with the Masters, with the British Open, with the BCS Championship, with Monday Night Football, I would have probably given you a similar answer. So I'm ruling nothing out.
This is probably like asking a parent to pick their favorite child, but do you have a favorite sport that you follow?
No.
Oh, come on.
No, I like them all. I'm fans of all those sports.
Favorite team?
This is getting worse.
I know. I'm trying.
I'm not going there. My favorite team is my son's high school football team. You know, that's my favorite team.
George Bodenheimer. He's the president of ESPN. George, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
To hear what George Bodenheimer had to say about ESPN and the business of sports, head to our website. It's marketplace.org. We've got the whole archive of our series, Conversations from the Corner Office, online there as well. My life this weekend is going to revolve around schlepping four kids to and from soccer practice, the beach, or whatever else they have going on, with an extra day of that thrown in for Labor Day. I'll spend a little bit of time working on a project we've got lined up here for next week, but for most of us, Labor Day isn't really about the labor part at all. It's the ultimate weekend, the last long break before summer disappears. A fitting time, we thought, for a brief history of the American weekend, courtesy of Chrissy Clark.
The really short and mostly right history of the weekend can be captured on a bumper sticker.
The labor movement, the folks who brought you the weekend.
Ricardo Levins Morales is an artist and labor activist in Minneapolis, and he, in fact, makes that bumper sticker. He designed it in the early 1980s, in an era when unions were losing favor. Since then, he's sold tens of thousands. He says it's funny to watch people in the rearview mirror squinting with puzzled looks at the stickers.
For people who are not steeped in labor history, it might take a few minutes to figure out what on earth are they talking about. You know, the weekend has always been here like the weather.
It is hard to imagine life without the weekend. But the word didn't even exist until the 1870s, when Americans were deep into the Industrial Revolution.
Many working people were fresh off of the farms, and they were used to regulating their own day and their own working rhythms. And here, all of a sudden, they were having to adapt themselves to whistles, to bells, to the clock.
The clock on the wall. So much can be done in a day if Americans will keep their sleeves rolled up.
Many workers, men, women, and children, put in 10 to 16-hour days, 7 days a week. And you remember this part. Labor organizers called on the government to mandate shorter hours. Workers lost lives in the struggle. At Haymarket Square in Chicago, police gunned down protesters, and men were hanged for inflammatory speeches. The men were demanding, as they put it, time for what we will.
The right to have time with our families, to pursue education.
To go to the zoo, to go to church. Actually, getting Sunday off for worship was relatively easy. It was Saturday that was the hard part.
If the Jewish Sabbath had been on Wednesday, we would not have a weekend. We'd have Wednesday and Sunday off.
And what kind of weekend is that? Historian Michael Feldman says even as Americans agitated for more time off, 2 days off right next to each other was not a foregone conclusion. He says for that, we can thank the massive influx of Jewish immigrants in the late 1800s. They made up a big part of the factory workforce, and their holy day was not Sunday.
And Jews, for the most part, had to either voluntarily not conduct business on Saturday while the rest of the country did, or abandon their religious principles to make a living, keep a job.
But Jewish and Gentile factory workers aren't the only ones who brought you the weekend. Some of the guys who owned the factories helped, too.
Travel this year the roads to romance, to places you have always wanted to go. And when you travel, go in one of the quality motor cars.
Guys like Henry Ford. He hated labor unions, but he shared their hope in this strange new thing called a weekend. He gave his workers 2 days off way before he had to. He pretty much invented weekend road trips and promoted them in editorials. Christian Overland of the Henry Ford Museum puts it this way. Ford wanted to sell his Model T, and if people were stuck in factories all week...
Well, when are they going to use it?
Right. When the hell do they have the time?
If your workforce is your consumer,
you have to give people the time off to buy the things.
And take them out on weekend adventures and drives in the country and later trips to the mall. So who invented the weekend? It was brought to you by the labor movement, but also management, Jews and Gentiles, and you may as well throw in God, since he came up with the whole day of rest thing in the first place. In Los Angeles, I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
As we travel the roads to romance.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, something I've been meaning to mention for a couple of days now. Have you seen the price of gold lately? It's part economic fundamentalism and part common sense, but the shiny yellow stuff is traditionally held to be the safest of safe havens, a place to put your money when you think the economy's going down the drain. With that in mind, I offer you today's high, $997.20 an ounce. Just for some context here, gold last year when Lehman Brothers went under and people were thinking economic catastrophe, nowhere even close, down below $800 an ounce. So have a nice weekend, everybody. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 96 points. That's 1%. The NASDAQ gained 35 points, 1.75%. The S&P 500 up 13 points, 1.3%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, the recession has hit a lot of neighborhoods hard, but Sesame Street?
Yeah, Elmo's family too. Ever since Elmo's mommy lost her job, boy, it's been a big change.
Why Elmo's Talking Finance. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.